Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today's theme is called, says Peter, Foreign Parts, which could be taken a number of ways. Let's just launch into it.
Some of the people are non-U.S. based, but the concepts are all foreign.
Okay.
So we've got some Japan, we've got some Chile, we've got some Germany, and what's the other one? And then we've got Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
So we're covering most of the continents in a single program around a central theme of great things that are happening that affect the United States, but we'd started off somewhere else. So where do we begin this morning?
With the very, very delightful Bruce Bailey, who happens to own the largest Japanese supermarket chain outside of Japan, I think.
That doesn't necessarily make it very large.
Well, I don't know.
But it is unique. As you'll hear when
he's delightful to work with.
Yeah, and you'll find out more as we talk to Bruce.
I must say, Bruce Bailey, that you were the very first owner of a Japanese supermarket chain that I've ever talked to.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Yes. Now, the name of your chain is Mitsuwa Marketplace, and it means something.
That's correct. Mitsu is the Japanese word for three, and wa is three together or three in harmony, and Mitsuwa refers, the way we chose the name is it refers to the three partners who initially purchased the company, and we had worked together and been very compatible.
Well, you were co-owner, president, and CEO, but your background is absolutely intriguing. Could you run us through we've three different components to your background, at least.
Well, yes, I went to college and law school at UCLA in Los Angeles. Graduated there, and very shortly after graduation, I went into the Army and was stationed in Japan, and I lived there for a total of 18 months. While I was there, I actually was admitted to the Japanese Bar Association.
Oh, that's hysterical.
It is, although I've never practiced law there. I just did it because I had a lot of spare time and there was nothing else to do.
And you're Japanese. Is that good to do law?
Well, not anymore. That was a long time. I was able to get by at that point. Then I came back to the U.S., and just, again, by chance, not by design, the firm I was with started representing large Japanese companies coming into the U.S. to do business. And so naturally that fell, at least in part, to me.
Uh-huh.
I did that for quite a while. And at that point, there was a client of the firm who was not a Japanese client. It was a client that did a lot of marketing. And they asked me to come over, be president of the company, and help straighten out some things that they did. For a couple of years, I was a president of a fairly significant marketing company. Then I came back to the practice and met a Japanese company called Yaohan, which is a large department store and supermarket company from Japan. I worked with them and a young guy who was opening the stores for them. We became very good friends. In 1997, he told me that the department store company in Japan had filed the largest bankruptcy.
Oh, wow.
I believe it was the largest bankruptcy in Japanese history.
Oh, my.
And the trustee in bankruptcy was going to close all of the operations outside of Japan. So I talked with him and with another one of the people that was a key person, and we got together and said, let's buy the operations in the U.S. And so we did. We changed the name from Yaohan to Mitsuwa because there were three of us. And went on from there.
How did you evaluate? I guess you locate your stores in locations where there is an established customer base, right?
Exactly. We established stores typically where there was a fairly heavy Japanese customer base available, although today that has changed quite a bit. The Japanese base has moved out of the major cities. We're in Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, and the San Jose, Silicon Valley area, as well as San Diego. But that has changed, and we do a lot of internet sales as well.
Okay. Well, since you mentioned that, why don't you give us your website so we don't forget to get that in?
Oh, good. Yeah, it's www.mitsuwa.com.
Okay. No marketplace.
No marketplace. It's mitsuwa.com.
Okay. And now, I guess I was curious at the outset, is this representing just fulfilling a need of Japanese people living abroad, or is it like a growing popularity of Japanese products?
Oh, no, definitely a growing popularity of Japanese food products. There is a growing understanding in the general population, certainly the Asian population, but in the general population, that Japanese food is healthy, it's low calorie, and the biggest problem that we have is people want it, they like it, but they don't know how to prepare it and what the menus ought to be. So we are making a big effort to educate the non-Japanese population on exactly those things.
You do that in your stores? You have cooking demos and things?
Yeah, we actually now have three of the stores have demonstration kitchens, and it's not just some little table someplace. They're very nice, beautiful kitchens. They'll have video screens and audio so that people can see and hear what the chefs are doing. And we actually have well-known chefs come in to show how to prepare food.
Yeah, well, of course, we had the big sushi craze not too long ago, and I guess that's still going. Tell me about, like, what are the most... Oh, and the other thing I'm going to say is... the Fancy Food Show this year, I've noticed a trend, growing popularity of seaweed of all sorts.
Yeah, exactly. It's a basic, the Japanese food menu. You can get to various varieties of them. The most common is the one you would see in what they call sushi rolls and wrap it there.
Yeah.
But there are all kinds of Japanese products. Very different kinds of rice, for example. Very different kinds of soya sauce. Very different kinds of noodles, ramen or soba or so forth. And each one of those has its special qualities and taste and so forth.
Supermarkets that I've been in, they have a pattern. You walk in, and first you hit the produce aisles, and then you say, how is a Japanese supermarket laid out?
Well, and it depends which kind of supermarket you're talking about. In the, say, the regional stores, the layout would be fairly similar to an American supermarket. You walk in and you would see the produce. You go through the produce section in our stores, the fish, then to the meat. In the middle would be the frozen and the dry groceries. But our stores are a little bit different. That's why we call them a marketplace, because about 50% of our space is devoted to just what I told you. The other 50% will have a food court, and in the food court we'll have tenants, well-known Japanese names, serving Japanese food. We have bookstores. The largest mobile phone companies in Japan have shops in our stores. We have travel agencies.
Wow.
all sorts of things. And
that sounds absolutely fabulous.
So we call it a Mitsuwa Marketplace, and many supermarkets are designed as a place to go to buy something, and then you're going to leave to go home or someplace else. Our stores are designed as a destination. You invite people to come and make it interesting for them with events and so forth, so that and different kinds of shopping, so that they're going to be there a while.
Wow. You also said that you work with Japanese artisanal producers. That, to me, sounds very difficult.
Well, it is, I think, for most people, and we're probably the most successful company outside of Japan in doing that. You know, artisan producers of food products in Japan are very regional, and they typically are family companies that have been producing for a long time. To give you an example, I met with some of them who had been in the particular area for 200 years, and they were considered the new kids on the block. there was one that proudly had a sign on their building that said established in 1755, but they weren't the oldest. And so these folks are very careful about who they sell to. They are not enthusiastic about huge quantities of sales, and they are not enthusiastic about going outside of Japan. So, for example, I recently spoke with executives of a large U.S. Supermarket chain on the East Coast, And they were complaining that they would call these people. They got lists. They'd call these people. They'd never get a call back.
Yeah.
We have an office in Tokyo, and a couple people there that have been in the business of talking to these folks, the artists and producers, for over 20 years, 30 years maybe. And you have to establish the relationships and cultivate those first, and then they have to determine that you're of a good enough quality so that they won't be embarrassed if you're selling their products. And so we have a big advantage in having the Tokyo office and in long-term relationships with people.
Now, one of the things that people seem to get worried about these days in the locavore movement, as we might call it, is the food miles that are on a product when it arrives. Now, your products must have a fairly large number of food miles on them by the time they get to your stores.
It depends on which products. And the ones that I was just talking about, the artisan products, that is true. They're packaged, they're shipped over here in containers and on boats. Some of it's frozen, some of it is just air-conditioned. So we keep it as fresh as possible, and we always watch expiration dates. All of the products have very specific expiration dates, and we don't sell anything that is close to an expiration date. The other thing that you should be aware of, though, is on, for example, meat products. You cannot import meat from Japan.
Yeah, they're very strict.
So in fact, a variety of the products you have are made in the U.S., but they're of a style that's like as if they were made in Japan.
Well, yes, exactly. What we do there is we import the employees who know how to do it. So we have a lot of employees with specific skills in meat, fish, produce, and those sorts of things that are directly from Japan. So if we can't import the product, we import the producer.
Wow. That's amazing.
Hold a minute. But does the producer, does the person you bring in, do they actually do the production, or do they simply help you to source product that's of the kind that they could approve of?
Oh, no. We bring in, for example, meat cutters. If you want shabu-shabu meat, it's cut very specifically, a very certain way. It's got to be very specific quality and type of meat. And so we bring the meat cutter in.
The cows themselves, grown in the United States.
That's correct, because you can't import it from Japan.
Sure, interesting. Now, you mentioned that before, and I was just clarifying that. Now,
exactly.
Are you able to source rice and seaweed and other products like that in the United States?
Yeah, the United States grows a large quantity of rice, and a lot of the producers of rice, particularly in the California Central Valley, are Japanese. So we get the same varieties they would get in Japan. And as a matter of fact, Japan imports some rice from the U.S.
Oh, that's funny.
In terms of other products, seaweed you mentioned, that typically will come from Japan. It's a dried product that is produced there.
I like it. I just munch on it.
She does, too.
I do.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, have you had any fallout, and I guess I shouldn't use that word, about the nuclear disaster?
Well, a couple of things. We made a big effort to provide and collect funds to send to Japan for earthquake relief. But for a while, it really dropped off. People were concerned about radiation and so forth.
Sure.
And that was probably a little over a year ago. It was probably April. The earthquake happened in March, and then April, May, June, our sales went down, and a lot of that was because some of the Asian markets, not the Japanese, but the Asian markets, Chinese markets, Korean markets, started advertising, beware of Japanese food.
That's not nice.
And so we got questions about that, but it became clear that the Japanese government and the Customs and FDA and so forth very carefully watched anything coming in from Japan. And so, people then started to realize it wasn't a problem, and it's certainly come back strongly.
Now, across the country, in areas where you don't have stores, you're attracting sufficient online shoppers? I mean, online shopping is popular?
Yeah, online. We've always had a mail order, I call it a net shop, but a mail order shop. But internet shopping has become a lot more popular, and our sales are growing. We probably doubled our internet sales last year. I would hope that we would do that again this year.
Now, are there resources on your website that will let people know what kind of, you know, if I want to cook this kind of food, these are the ingredients that I need?
There are some recipes on there. We're redoing the website right now to make it a lot easier just exactly to do what you're talking about. The new website's probably going to be operating in another 3 or 4 months. But if you go to our website right now, it'll be in English or Japanese. You take your pick. You can find various food products and some recipes and links to other recipes.
Well, that sounds good. Language is a big issue. When I was working for the City Magazine, they decided to take this whole city guide and translate it into Japanese. I mean, you think this was a mad idea. Consider that our features editor who was in charge of this project was Chinese.
Well, you know, we do some advertising in Chinese papers. A significant number of our customers are Chinese these days.
Yeah, well, she wasn't really excited about Japanese. And then the advertisers, it was a hoot. I mean, translating some of the stuff that came in made no sense whatsoever.
Oh, yeah. You have to be a little careful about the translation.
Oh, yes.
There are some computer programs that claim to translate, but you get some very odd...
Well, sure. Well,
I'm sure you know
Japanese, so you can imagine how Pepsi would do with a slogan like, "Come alive, it's the Pepsi generation."
Okay.
It had something to do with drinking the blood of your ancestors.
It just doesn't work.
Well, how big do you expect to get?
What, in terms of the company?
Yes.
That's tough to say. We're not going to be expanding very much in terms of a number of stores.
Okay.
There are some places that would be, let's say, prime targets. The Seattle area, maybe Honolulu, maybe Washington, D.C. So what we're going to do is focus on what we are doing right now to do it better, and then I think the future is certainly Internet sales.
Right. Well, that's. I've switched a lot of stuff to Internet, too, myself. So I guess for a while, though, I'm content with my little local superette, my Japanese superette.
Mm-hmm.
It's family-run. It's very nice, and they have most anything I want.
Well,
so,
good.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, anyhow, you are a fascinating person, Bruce Bailey, and I think your work is fascinating, too. You must be really having a really good time with all of this.
I certainly am. It is fascinating and very enjoyable, and so I'm looking forward to going forward.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Bruce. It was a pleasure talking to you.
And a pleasure talking to you.
And we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are, right back indeed, moving you along to Chile.
Yeah, we're going west, quite a long way west and quite a long way south, but with a California connection.
Right.
So everything interesting and new begins in California, I guess. Well, in this case, it began in Chile, but it was work done that started out with an interest in fine olive oil being grown in the United States, and then gentlemen realizing that Chile had an excellent climate for growing olive oil, and why not set about it in the right way? So he certainly did, and I think you'll find it a fascinating story.
Well, we're always delighted, of course, to find a new, so high a grade of olive oil as yours. We're talking actually to Jay Rosengarten, whose company is called Olisur Extra Virgin Olive Oil, and we were sampling the Santiago Premium Extra Virgin Olive Oil from Chile. So we have another entrant into the universe of olive oil. Welcome to On the Menu, Jay. You were telling us a while ago how you got into this. You are a career food person, are you not?
I am. Yes. I am. And I've been in the food industry almost my whole career. I've been in the retail business with running some fairly high-end food stores around the country, and in the food logistics business, and I've had a consulting business working with many product companies around the U.S. primarily, but also in Europe, helping them develop their go-to-market strategies.
Well, this was not accidental that all of a sudden I turned around and Chile had a huge presence at the Fancy Food Show.
That's correct. I mean, the Chilean government has really the olive oil business in Chile, which is brand new. I mean, we're looking at an olive oil industry that's probably 10 or 12 years old from the standpoint of going to market. Now, they've grown olives in Chile for a much longer period of time than that, but not for use as in the marketplace. It's kind of an interesting story. I mean, you asked how I got involved with them.
Right.
And I met the people from Olisor, the Fancy Food Show, about 5 years ago. And they had the Santiago premium bottle issue as you described. The olive oil was fantastic. I was actually introduced to them through an Italian friend of mine who said, you know, they could probably use your help. I think the olive oil is really great. And I tasted it. I liked the oil. I didn't know all that much about it other than I found it to be very good. But I looked at the bottle, and my initial impression was, you know what, the bottle's a little too high if you really want to get serious about that because we can't fit it on the shelf. And that started about a three-month conversation. And one of my focuses when I work with clients, and I now work for the company, I'm now actually president of the North American business, but one of my focuses is that you need to answer a question why the world needs, and in the olive oil world, at least a few years ago, that wasn't necessarily an easy question to answer. There's lots of olive oils. It's a very crowded space. Everybody can go to Europe and basically create a label and buy an olive oil and put it on the shelf, and that's what's happened, particularly in the U.S. So as we talked about this over 3 months, they got tired of hearing it from me, and they finally said, well, we want you to come to Chile, and we want you to see what we've done. And I flew to Chile. I got off the plane at 6 o'clock in the morning. We drove about 100 miles south of Santiago to the farm, and I took one step out of the car, and in fact, we got blown away by what they had done. And in fact, we will be single estate growers and producers of olive oil in the world in the next couple of years. And what that simply means is that we own the trees, we harvest the fruit, we store the oil, we bottle the oil, we're completely vertically integrated. In fact, all of the oil that we have in our brands, we can actually trace back just about to the tree. Pretty amazing.
Jay, hold on a second. Olisor has broken quite a few rules in the production, in the growing and the production of that oil, like the density of the trees, and the mm-hmm. use of irrigation and the mechanical picking so that it's in the bottle within 2 hours of being picked.
And what we did is we didn't break the rules, we created the rules, because it was really interesting. The individual who owns Olisor is an entrepreneur from Chile. They own a lot of other agribusinesses. You may be familiar with a company called Nature Ripe Strawberries and Blueberries, which is one of the largest sellers of strawberries and blueberries in the U.S. And their companies own that brand and have had it for 25 years. And he got interested in olive oil about 10 or 12 years ago when he was traveling through Spain and Italy and looking at the way they grew olives and produced oil, and said, you know, I think we could do that better in Chile. And he came back to Chile, and he brought together a group of world experts. And what were they? They weren't at that point olive oil experts, but they were climate, irrigation, soil. And they brought together the largest olive tree nursery in Spain. And he brought these people in a room and he said, look, I have three questions for you. One is, can we grow olives in Chile? And they knew the answer to that was yes, because the climate is very similar to the Mediterranean climate, just in the area that we're in. Can I grow olives that will produce an oil that will be a very high quality olive oil? And three is, can I do it productively? Because if I'm going to get into the olive oil business, I want to sell it at a price that people will actually buy the oil and enjoy it. And that's really the game changer in this category, because almost all of the olive oil that you see in the U.S. is not from single estate, or if it is from single estate, it's being sold at a very fancy gourmet store for $35, $40, $50 for a 500 ml bottle. And so the answer to the questions was yes. And with that information, he went out and he asked them to find a piece of land. And they found the farm, which is about 100 miles south of Santiago, in the Cochagua Valley, which is one of the premier wine valleys of Chile, and wine grapes do well together and grow in the same climate. And then he built the farm and grew the trees, and he developed everything with the technique that's being used. So as a result of it, we have high-density trees, which is today the most modern way of growing some of the olive varieties, not all. Our land has a topography that allows us to 12 varieties of olives, because what we found is that some olives like flat land, some olives like very steep slope. I mean, you've been to Tuscany, I'm sure, and you know in Tuscany, if you go to the wine country, you know how hilly and steep it is, and the olive varieties that grow in Tuscany like that type of soil condition. Well, on our farm, we have that soil condition along with other conditions. So the land was very specifically purchased so that we could grow olives in a good climate, and we could grow a variety of olives that would give us the ability to create different flavor profiles. And that's why we have Santiago Premium, Santiago Limited, and Olive, because each one has same quality if you measure quality by the chemistry. The acidity level of all of our oils is less than 0.2%. We actually put that on the bottle. It's all stint grown. The oil gets to the from the tree to the press within 2 hours, and it's a result of that process that the acidity is very low, because the olives, any fruit, if it sits around, it decays, it deteriorates, it rots, and the longer it sits around, the higher the acidity. So what we find is that we have an olive oil, our olive, because of our process, from the time we harvest it until the time we press it, never exceeds a couple of hours. And as a result of that, the olive, which is a fruit, never gets a chance to deteriorate. The acidity level of our oil is pretty much the natural acidity level, the European standard for extra virgin olive oil. And that creates our acidity level of 2.2% or less. The standards in Europe to be called extra virgin olive oil, the acidity level can be at least 0.8.
So you're dealing with a much fresher product. And it seems that your market penetration is based on, here I've got a higher quality product, and I can make it available to you for slightly less money than you're paying for what you're using now. Is that sort of netted out?
That's exactly right. And we do that because of the modern agricultural techniques that we've employed at the farm. We only produce extra virgin olive oil because we don't have any refined oils. We don't do that. We don't blend. When we blend varieties of olives, which is what creates the flavors. And everything we do at the farm is sustainable. So as an example, we take the flesh and the pulp from the olives that are left after we get the extracted, after we extract the oil. And we compost that, and we use it for organic fertilizer in the fields the next year. We take the pits and we grind, and we use them to fuel the generators that supply the electricity to the factory. And the factory is right in the middle of the farm. So it gives us the kind of control over our oil and over our end product that, frankly, nobody in this business has.
Jay, I want to ask you one last question. It's probably a slightly unfair question, but it's still kind of important, I think, to your long-term success has to be somewhat dependent on Chile being on the map of the olive oils of the world, don't you think? And how do you think that's going to happen?
Well, I think it's beginning to happen. I think what's beginning to happen very clearly is there's become a recognition among buyers, among the food press generally, and I think growing among consumers, particularly in North America, that the best olive oil in the world is being brought to market today is actually being brought to market by the New World producers. And that includes California, Chile, and Australia. Very simple. California Olive Commission has done a tremendous amount of work, and they're doing even more work about trying to establish, as you know, more stringent standards for extra-virgin olive oil. And we applaud that. We support that because that's very consistent. We're all producing it the same way. It's consistent. We comply with all of that. We're very happy about that. And I think there's been so much publicity now about what's really in the bottle when it says imported from Italy. I mean, if you look at the two leading brands in the U.S., Filippo Berio and Bertone, both of them on the front of their bottles say imported from Italy. And I ask people all the time, where does it come from?
The answer is most of it comes in tankers from Spain.
Not only Spain. If you look at the back of the bottle, in very small print, it's in the U.S. we require a country of origin to be spelled out. They say very clearly there are four or five countries of origin. And it could be Spain, Italy, Tunisia, Greece, Morocco, Argentina, and the list goes on. So as a result of that, you never know where the oil is coming from.
Tell me this, Jay. Could you give me 3 adjectives describing Ole Soar olive oil?
Fresh, grassy, wonderful flavor. That's what it's all about. It's, if you compare it, if you taste it, and I do this all the time, when I go in to present this to buyers, I bring all the leading competitive brands into the room with them. And these are not necessarily people, even though they're buying food, they don't necessarily have sophisticated palates. I've done this with consumers. I've done this with writers.
But you're comparing it to the well-known brands. You're not comparing to artisanal producers.
I have.
Okay, so you're positioning the Ole Soar olive oil as well, positioning also against artisanal producers.
Without the quality of our brand is equivalent to the most expensive olive oil you can buy in the United States. Won over 20 gold medals internationally, including Milan, Los Angeles, Montreal, as the best olive oil of the year. By the way, all of our brands, not just one.
Uh-huh.
In their categories.
Jay, you've sounded like you're going to fall off the edge of the world pretty soon.
Sorry, I don't need to do it. But, you know, it's a very exciting project for me because we have something in this category that's so unique when I compare it to others. Great, and it's a great value. And the reason is very simply, we have a lot of olive oil to sell. We want people to enjoy fresh olive oil and understand the difference. You asked about, let me give you a real experience we had. About a year ago, it was actually 2 years ago, we invited a number of writers to come to Chile to witness the harvest. And we had 8 writers from the U.S. and Canada came. And they were all pretty savvy food people. I mean, we're talking about writers from Food and Wine. We have a tea and travel. I mean, they were really a savvy group of writers and invited an expert from Italy to give them a seminar on how to taste olive oil, how to recognize defects and qualities, etc. And it was about a 2-hour seminar. And at the end of it, I asked everybody if they would do a blind taste test. I had sent down about 15 brands of olive oil, including some of the $50 bottles of, you know, DOP olive oil from Italy, to do this tasting. And they agreed to do it, and they did the blind taste testing, and it was truly blind, and we had our brands in there as well. And we asked them to score it, and at the end of the tasting, to pick the top 3, in their view, the top 3. The top 2 were Santiago and Olive.
Oh, wow. Huh?
I couldn't make that up, and as
well,
a result of it, we got tremendous, we've had a tremendous amount of press as a result of it, but you can't make that up. These are people you can't fool. You know, they're very, very savvy people, and it just happens all the time when I have these taste testings.
You know, I think Chile's on the rise, and you're in a good position there. And I think you're a great spokesperson for the brand.
So have
a good trip, Jay.
And stay with us because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We're back and moving across the globe once again to this country we used to call Ceylon, to the colony of the British Empire, which we used to call Ceylon, which is the same place which became Sri Lanka, and has its own fascinating food heritage, which the author of the book we're just about to talk to made his own and decided to share with the rest of the world. And he was really interesting chap, wasn't he?
Yes, this is the only time I think we've ever had Sri Lankan cooking on.
There we go. So, and it's Indian, but not, as you'll find out.
Hello, Skiz Fernando Jr. How are you?
Just fine, thanks, Anne.
Yeah, no, you have a book here called Rice and Curry, which is the title of your book, but it also is the terminology for food in Sri Lanka. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's what, as Sri Lankans, that's what we call our cuisine, kind of like the colloquial term for it. But really, rice and curry encompasses a lot of different dishes. Rice is the staple food, so that's the centerpiece of any meal. And along with the rice, you eat several meat or vegetable curries. You eat fresh salad, you eat a pickle, and it's all served together. So it's a really kind of amazing meal.
It's sort of like Indian cooking in that it all comes at the same time, right?
Exactly, exactly. We don't have courses. It's all served together. Right. And you have a bit of this and a bit of that. And basically all of the tastes are represented: sweet, sour, salty, bitter, spicy. All those flavors are included in one meal.
Is there a special kind of umami in Sinhalese cuisine?
Well, that term is a Japanese term, and I think all Asian cuisines kind of share that quality in common, in that I've been to other Asian countries and it's similar. They serve a lot of different flavors together, sometimes even in the same dish. And so I think that's a common trait that Asian cuisine.
Now, you're talking to somebody who is, well, me. I am geographically challenged. Peter actually has an advanced degree in geography.
Yes, I know exactly where Sri Lanka is.
So I said, where is Sri Lanka?
And Peter's also got an advantage. He's British.
So
they were once our colonial overlord, I guess.
Yeah, overlord's a good term.
You bet. Well, you sound like you managed to learn to speak the language okay.
I was actually, Peter, born in this country. I was born and raised in the U.S., in Corpus Christi, Texas, of all places.
Yeah, of all places.
Now, how did your family get here?
That's kind of a long story, but to make a long story short, my parents were one of the first Sri Lankans to emigrate to this country in, like, the early 60s. And at the time, they were only giving visas, and I'm not joking, they were only giving visas to either rocket scientists or Montessori teachers.
Montessori.
And my mother happened to be a Montessori teacher, so she was also one of the first Montessori teachers to come to the U.S. And, you know, since then, Montessori has become pretty huge in America. And my mother now trains Montessori teachers.
Oh, wow.
But that was how my family ended up in America. I was born in Texas and pretty much raised on the East Coast. And I went to college and graduate school here. But the food was always my connection to my home culture. So that's why food was always very important to me. And growing up, we used to eat rice and curry two or three times a week. And at a certain point, you know, when you go away from home, especially when you go to college and you get horrible institutional food, you kind of
yes.
long for the cooking of your mother once again. So I used to call my mother and call my brother and ask them how to make chicken curry, how to make this. And eventually I wanted to learn how to make all of the dishes that I grew up with. So in 2007, found myself with not much work here, so I decided to leave the country for a year, go to Sri Lanka, and just study Sri Lankan cuisine from the ground up, you know, from the spices, from how to shop for produce and meats and stuff at the open-air markets.
Well,
and it was an amazing year. Amazing.
You have a whole family still extended.
Oh, yeah, yeah. My whole extended family is over there, aunts, uncles, cousins. And, you know, my mother was one of eight kids, and my father was one of six kids, so you can imagine how much of a huge family I have there. And they were all very instrumental in making this book happen, because that's where I started as far as getting recipes from. I hit up all my aunts who are all very good cooks. And what I used to do is I used to make a few dishes every day and go to a different aunt's house for lunch and take the dishes with me and provide them with lunch, and I would get an excellent critique of the food. So that's how I learned. They would say a little less chili, a little more of this. And basically all of the dishes in my book, Rice and Curry, I've cooked at least 20 times myself.
See, that's really great.
So
What a setup, huh?
Yeah, it's amazing because, you know, a lot of times I get cookbooks by celebrity chefs and I try a dish and it just doesn't come out right. And I'm like, is this for real? Is this celebrity chef really make this dish? So you don't have to worry about that with my book, because I'm not a celebrity chef at all. I'm proud to be a home cook, and that's why the book is called Sri Lankan Home Cooking, because all of this food is meant to be made in the home. This is what people in Sri Lanka eat every day.
Yeah, that's what they say about Indian food, that the only real food you're going to get is in the home.
Exactly.
But the great thing about it also is you tested the recipes, and you must be a little bit accomplished in the kitchen, otherwise you wouldn't have even tried to do this.
You know, I love to cook. You know, that's always been kind of a hobby, but I kind of focus on different things as far as career-wise. I was, I ran a record label at one point. I've always been a journalist, and then I got into filmmaking and making documentaries and stuff, but cooking was always on the back burner, no pun intended, or actually pun intended. So when I actually had the chance to go there for a year, it was amazing, because that's all I did was deal with food.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, but nowadays, do you have like a day job too?
No, I'm still pretty much freelance. I work in a lot of different fields, and right now I take a lot of jobs in the film video arena, but I still write. I'm a journalist, and I'm still doing music as well. So these are all interests of mine, so uh-huh. There's no reason to stop doing them.
I think we should say that I would have been more up on Sri Lanka if I had known that they had changed the name from Ceylon, which was, nobody told me that.
Did that happen immediately upon independence in 1948? I don't remember.
No, I believe it happened a lot later.
That's what I thought.
Because
yeah.
I knew it as Ceylon, so,
And everyone still knows Ceylon tea. It's still called Ceylon tea.
That's true, too. Yeah.
It's almost like a trademark. It's almost like champagne.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's champagne is not to drink from a certain region. So, like, the tea is still called Ceylon tea because that's what the world knows our tea as. It's very big. I know it's big in Britain, but it's also very big in the Middle East, Ceylon tea, and they know it by that name.
Well, your book covers a lot here. You have a section which is a primer on traveling to Sri Lanka, which I think is luring me there. You then go into specific flavorings. What are some of the things that make Sri Lankan cooking different from its neighbors? I mean, what are the unique things? I have the feeling it has to do with a lot of these spices, which you have a very extensive chapter on the spices and other essential ingredients. Could you go through some of them?
Sure thing, and that's a very good question, because as a Sri Lankan, I'm always kind of frustrated when people assume Sri Lankan food is just like Indian food. Well, obviously, we have a lot of things in common. India's is our biggest neighbor to the north, and the history of our two countries have been intertwined since antiquity. But Sri Lanka is an island, and it also has its own history. We had three different European colonial powers there, first the Portuguese, then the Dutch, then the British, and with that exposure to Europe and its cuisines, that had an effect on our food as well. We've also had a significant influence from Arab traders who have introduced dishes such as biryani into the Sri Lankan canon.
Now tell me what that is.
Biryani is just basically meat cooked in rice.
Oh, okay, biryani. Yeah.
And it's kind of like a Mughal dish. The Mughals, yeah, who once ruled Pakistan and most of India, came from the Middle East, and they were basically Islamic. But they had very rich cuisine. It was kind of like it was a courtly cuisine for the rulers. But getting back to Sri Lankan food, I would say that the biggest difference between Sri Lankan food and what we call Indian food, even though that's such a misnomer, because India is a huge country.
Oh, yes,
and
there's so many different.
Tremendously diverse regionally. But the Indian food that we know in the U.S. is pretty much northern Indian food.
Right.
Which relies heavily on dairy, milk, yogurt, ghee, which is clarified butter. In Sri Lankan food, we don't use any of that. Our main fats are coconut oil and coconut milk. Because we're an island, we have tons of coconut trees all over the place. So the coconut is a very important part of Sri Lankan cuisine. You'll find coconut milk in a lot of curries, and you'll find actually raw shredded coconut also.
I sort of always use that in curries, actually.
Yeah, and you know, it's kind of like Thai food in that way, because the Thais are heavy on the coconut milk.
But I must say that your illustration, the photograph of how you're going to cut open a coconut sent shivers up my spine. You have this poor man holding a coconut with this big machete coming down on it.
Well, you use the blunt end of the machete, but yeah, I think in America, I think most people are going to opt for the can of coconut milk, which is what I do too when I make curries. I just pull out a can of coconut milk.
We don't. We make it from scratch.
Really? Wow. Well, more power to you.
Cause
cut open coconuts and peeled the,
I know you have.
The brown skin off, and it's a
I know you've done that. You've also bought we've also bought cans from the supermarket too.
Sometimes.
But obviously, if you chop open the coconut and make coconut milk fresh, it's going to be that much better. But
oh, sure.
The can is definitely an acceptable substitute. Now, one thing I wouldn't substitute, which is to me, it's like the signature flavor of Sri Lankan food, is the fresh curry leaf. And this you can buy at Indian stores, you can buy it at Thai stores, and I've even seen it at Whole Foods now, which is great. Because I wouldn't even try to make Sri Lankan food without fresh curry leaves. That's how important that flavor is. And also, another important spice is obviously the chili. Sri Lankan food is some of the hottest food in the world.
Oh, is it? See,
I think the only hotter food I've had is in Mexico, like on the street.
Yeah, we have a whole pile here of red chili, dried.
We use dried red chilies. We use fresh green chilies. And the interesting thing is, though, we do not use in the Sri Lankan curry powder. The Sri Lankan curry powder is a blend of 13 different spices, including coriander, cumin, fennel, black mustard seeds, fenugreek, and all of these spices are roasted before they're ground together. So when you roast them, you release more of the essential oils. You get a nice smoky taste. So that's another unique part of Sri Lankan cuisine is our roasted curry powder. You will not find that in India. You will not find that in any other country in Asia.
Well, Indians toast their ingredients for curry.
They toast the whole ingredients and they use them whole, but we toast all these ingredients and then we grind them into a powder.
Uh-huh.
And we also use raw rice, which is ground up, and it's like a thickening agent.
Well, can we say that you actually sell your special blend
of
curries? Curry, and you have two varieties, as I read in the book, I think, the plain and the smoked. I mean, the raw and the smoked.
The raw and the roasted. Now, the roasted curry powder is used for meat and fish curries. It's definitely like a stronger taste. And the raw curry powder, which is only made of three ingredients, coriander seeds, cumin seeds, and fennel seeds.
Wow.
That is what we use for our vegetable curries. But that blend is what you will find mostly in most other countries' curry powder, coriander, cumin, and fennel,
right.
And then turmeric, which is that yellow spice which they use for color.
Right. Now, how about a web link to getting this, ordering this curry?
Okay, it's sold on a gourmet food site called foodoro.com. That's foodoro.com. They're based in San Francisco, and they only handle artisanal products, so they have like an amazing selection of stuff, from artisanal chocolate to cookie mix to curry powder. So
I wanted to say there are some of these that I've never heard of, of course, some of these spices,
some of the spices
and some of the ingredients, but it certainly shows how far we've come, that not all of them are totally foreign to me.
You'd be surprised, Anne. All of these ingredients are available in the U.S., either online or at specialty stores, or I said even like Whole Foods these days has fresh curry leaves, and they have lemongrass stalks, whole lemongrass stalks, which we also use.
Well, I used to grow that, but it was a pain because you had to keep bringing it in the summer.
And then
in the winter.
And then hopefully maybe they'll be featuring your curry powder too.
Yep, I'm definitely trying to get the curry powder into Whole Foods, so hopefully cross our fingers and hopefully that'll happen.
I'd have to build a factory, huh? You probably can't make it all in your kitchen at home.
Well, what I do is I rent out a commercial kitchen, but for sure, if the business expands, I'll have to expand.
And here you are hanging with Tony Bourdain, huh? Was that fun?
No, that was great, because I was such a big fan of the show, and then to actually be on the show and to show him around my country was fab.
And he's with Leela. I can't believe how tiny Leela is. I mean, she's 4 feet tall?
Leela, yeah. Basically, that was my aunt's cook for like 42 years, and she retired, and now she lives back in her village, which is near the town of Chilao on the east coast of Sri Lanka. And Chilao is famous for their huge crabs.
Oh,
they've got these huge lagoon crabs, And they export them actually all over the place, especially like Singapore, because Singapore has a kind of a signature dish called chili crab,
uh-huh.
and they use Sri Lankan lagoon crab. But
well, I think that this is a welcome addition because we don't know nearly enough about Sri Lankan cooking at all, especially home cooking. And I think that this book is packed with information.
Yes,
it's certainly a revelation to me.
So don't be put off by the very bland title. Rice and curry. There are a lot of wonderful culinary surprises in here, and it's going to become part of my cooking portfolio very soon. Miss Anne, you better watch out.
Oh dear.
Excellent. That's the whole purpose of it, because you know, people are cooking at home more. People are more adventurous as far as, you know, when it comes to trying different types of food. So what I say is, if I can make these dishes, so can you. I'm not a professional chef. I'm just an avid home cook who likes to experiment and try new things. And I feel like Sri Lankan food has been my own little private secret all my life. So I'm just sharing it with all of you.
Everyone rush out and get this book called Rice and Curry by Skiz Fernando Jr.
Skiz, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Ann and Peter.
And don't go away, because we'll have another short segment right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again, as is our next guest. We've talked to her a number of times, one of our favorite people to talk to. Particularly, she represents a really out of this world company of knives, the best knives in the whole entire world. What I'm talking about, of course, is Wusthof as the company and their VP of Sales and Marketing, Annette Garrity. So let's listen to Annette.
About an unusual knife, shall we say the least.
Oh, I love this knife.
A bread knife. I must confess, I know it works. I'm not sure I still understand why, even after she's explained it so many times. But you'll probably catch on first time.
Well, we're getting to be a frequent conversationalist, Annette Garrity. Yes, I mean, how many times have we talked? You are Vice President of Sales and Marketing at Wusthof, and don't you do a fine job of that, too? I think that I support your belief that this is like the best knife company in the whole entire world.
Well, thank you. I agree. I love working for a brand that I can stand behind so much.
Well, you certainly can. And this latest knife that you released, I have been waiting for a bread knife that does not crush a crusty loaf of bread and create all that mess of crumbs. And you did it. Your new bread knife. What's it called?
We are calling it our classic 9-inch double serrated bread knife. And less crumbs is something that we didn't even know until we started using it. And then we were amazed that as we were cutting through very crusty loaves, it didn't make any crumbs like our traditional bread knives do.
Explain this technology. Why hasn't anybody figured it out before?
I'm not sure about that, but we're really excited. So basically what it means is there's your regular scallop or serration with the teeth that's on a bread knife, and inside each serration there's another additional serration. So that actually does your cutting for you, and the wonderful thing about it is the actual cutting edge never touches your cutting surface. The only thing that ever dulls a knife or hurts it is the surface.
Oh, so that's why you don't have to sharpen this.
Correct, because it will never, ever touch the surface.
That's a miracle. How do people get this? Is it in shop yet?
Right now it's available online at chefscatalog.com. They launched it for us, and it will be available nationwide at retailers on 9-1, September 1.
September 1, great. So it's chefscatalog.com.
Chefscatalog.com, yes.
Oh, great. Well, I think everybody should run and get this.
Hold on a minute. Let's repeat the name of the knife so that people make sure they get the right one.
It's a classic 9-inch double serrated bread knife.
Double serrated bread knife being the answer.
Correct.
You said something that I didn't quite understand, so maybe you can go over this again. You said that the cutting something never touches the surface. I'm puzzled by that.
Surface of the cutting.
Okay,
surface.
So the original, in a traditional bread knife, you have the serrations or scallops that have the teeth that actually grab the bread.
Got it.
In this, so those are the things that touch the cutting surface. So your cutting board that you're using, the teeth touch the surface. because the serrations, the double serration that's inside of the scallop, it will never hit the cutting board because the teeth will prevent it.
I see. Okay. All right. So it's almost like, sort of like it's on legs.
Exactly. Exactly.
Or stents or whatever you might call them.
Yeah. And you can cut more things than just bread with it too, huh?
Oh, absolutely. It's wonderful for anything with a fruit, or like a watermelon, anything with a harder exterior, softer interior. And because it's so incredibly sharp, it doesn't damage anything that's soft inside. So as well as it works on crusty loaves, it works very well on angel food cake or soft loaves that sometimes squished and are difficult to cut.
Right. Oh, wow. Well, I think it's ingenious, absolutely. Love it. And couldn't endorse it more heartily.
Probably be an ace for slicing really ripe tomatoes, too, huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
So you don't
get splashed in the eye with tomato seeds.
Well, as always, Annette, I thank you for talking to us about it. Do you want to announce your other new product, the Precision?
Sure. We just launched a new line. We partnered with Williams-Sonoma. It's exclusive to them. It's called Precision. It's a brand new technique on the bolster design, new blade shapes, and a new handle design. It still has the three rivets and the black handle, so it's very obviously Wusthof, but there's some really unique, inspired differences in this line. It just launched on 8-1. It's gotten rave reviews so far, so I'd love to have anybody go to Williams-Sonoma and check it out.
Yeah, they're beautifully designed shapes on top of everything else. They're very sleek.
Wow. And they also have the double serration on the bread knife in that line as well.
Oh, really?
So.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, you're always up to something. Let us keep letting us know what's developing.
We will do that.
Oh, and Annette, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. Hello to everybody at Wusthof.
Sounds great.
Thanks, Annette.
Take care.
Bye.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it, a lightning around the world trip with On the Menu. And we hope you'll join us again next week, same time, same place.
Bye-bye.